Welcome and good evening to another Miliband public lecture. I'm absolutely delighted to have Will Hutton here. Will is a close friend, someone whose work I've admired for a very long time, someone whose work I've read for a very long time, and I'm sure many of you have as well. Of course, he wanted to just have a title, Writing on the Wall, but I thought, you know, people might think that was about graffiti and so on. So it has, the subtitle is The Essence of the Matter, really, China's Rise in the Global Era, and Will is going to tell what I think is a fairly unconventional story about China and its prospects. But before Will starts, let me just say something about Will. He's the chief executive of the Work Foundation, in case you don't know, and that's an independent research-based consultancy, which is probably the most influential voice on work, workplace, and employment matters in Britain. He began his career as a stockbroker and investment analyst before moving to the BBC, where he worked in TV and radio as a producer and a reporter. He was, of course, editor-in-chief of The Observer for 4 years, and he continues to write a very well-received column in that newspaper. His record as a commentator on economic, social, and political affairs, I think, is pretty much second to none. He has single-handedly helped educate a generation of people on economic issues, economic policy debates, and so on. And if you followed his writings over the years in The Guardian and in The Observer, you can't help but be much better off and much better informed about key issues in economic policy than you probably were at the start. If that was not enough, he's written, of course, several best-selling books, by which I mean books that really sell well. The World We're In May 2002, The State We're In, The State to Come, The Stakeholding Society, and On the Edge. And he was also Political Journalist of the Year in the mid-1990s. Other roles include, no less, Governor of the LSE, thank you for all your efforts there, Will, and visiting fellowships and professorships at a variety of institutions. But none of this, in my view, gets to the heart of the matter or the heart of Will Hutton, because I think if you followed his work over time, it constitutes something of a national resource. I think Will Hutton is something of a national treasure, and we should take care of him well, even if we want to ask him very, very tough questions. So please join with me in giving him a very warm welcome.
Thank you. National treasure. Thank you very much for that, David. The writing on the wall. This is a bit of a fraud, actually, because when David asked me that I'd talk about this, my book, I thought I would have finished it by now. Delivery in America was meant to be February the 15th. Delivery in Britain was meant to be April the 1st. Well, I'm halfway through the conclusion, and I hope to have it finished in the next few days, which means, actually, that if this doesn't fly, this thesis that you're going to hear tonight, I have substantive chance to change it as a result of your reaction. So that's good news. So let me just get into the body of this immediately. The rise of China is a world event. Between 1870 and 1914, Angus Maddison, the great economic historian, estimates that US share of GDP rose from 5% to 16% on the eve of the First World War. When Deng Xiaoping took over China in December 1978, its share of world GDP was under 5%. In 2015, projections vary. Angus Maddison says 16. I learnt today from David that the British Treasury, think 19%. Over a similar period of time, China's is making itself felt just as America did 100 years ago. Moreover, it joins the United States as the last of the two great powers. By that I mean it's a continental economy. It has it's a continental civilization. It has the capacity for autonomous economic action and autonomous military action that actually only the United States has now. The rest of the world's powers, more or less, are market states, not China, not the United States. And I think the big question is that in the Atlantic Charter in August 1941, when Roosevelt and Churchill spelt out the terms of the post-war settlement, and then the Americans acted on it, abandoning their policy of ruralization of Japan in February 1947 and launching the Marshall Plan later that year, not particularly because they were interested in having an open world economy and a rules-based system as a matter of ideological conviction or even indeed economic conviction, but it was in their self-interest so to do. From 1947 to 1974, the United States did not prosecute Japanese exporters once, even though there were over 20,000 claims brought to the Department of Commerce by American producers. Such was their keenness to build up Japan in Asia as a liberal capitalist democracy. They took a similar blind eye to developments in Europe, having the same strategic interest. They have no strategic interest in building up China as a communist state, as the fourth biggest economy in the world. It's true that, of course, Chinese communism is not the communism of Mao. It is committed to the three represents, no longer class war. It doesn't pretend to be a dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasants. It is not trying to construct a socialist economy. It's trying to construct a socialist market economy. It is a member of the World Trade Organization. It is committed to peaceful rise, to harmony in international relations. And its growth has been astounding since Deng Xiaoping launched the famous reforms in 1978. Its economy is 9 times larger than it was then. 280 million people have been taken out of poverty. It has grown at somewhere between 9 and 10% per annum consistently for over 25 years. And you can't turn on the radio without Gordon Brown or George Osborne or Digby Jones telling you that China is coming. China, like Napoleon, will eat you up for breakfast. It is the big new thing. And for those of us who know something about China, one of the more comic spectacles took place in November of last year when Andrew Neil gave the Friedrich Hayek lecture celebrating China as a peon of free market success in contrast to the socialist communist economies of France and Germany. Proof positive was that France and Germany are growing at 1 or 2% per annum and China's growing at 10. We know that market economies are superior to any other. We know that Deng Xiaoping has had a market reform program. Ergo, China is a Hayekian success, and France and Germany are in the slough of despond. Anyone who's spent more than 30 seconds in China or has read almost anything about it could not make such an address. China, for all its remarkable successes, is run by the Communist Party. For all its ideological changes, it is a one-party state. And I call it a system not of, it's not a free market economy, as the World Trade Organization would like to define it. This is Leninist corporatism that we are watching arise in the East. And the bankruptcy of communism as an ideology since the Soviet Union collapsed in December 1991 means that one of the two pillars on which communist legitimacy hangs is its economic achievement. The other pillar is its increasing commitment to nationalism. And we have one great power emerging in the world with $2 trillion, fourth biggest economy in the world, set on some measures on purchasing power parity, the McDonald's comparison. It's already the second biggest economy in the world. It's as nationalist as the other great power in the world, the United States of America. And we live in a world in which nationalisms are on the advance and not in retreat. So I submit there are three big questions about this development. The first is, will the United States stay open and keep globalization going? Globalization, sure, has many bad aspects. David whose work I've read as more enthusiastically even than he's read mine, applauds the benefits that globalization has brought, even while insisting that it has to be governed and that the global institutions need to be deepened, democratized, strengthened. That is not on the agenda in Washington in 2006, and the open question is whether China, rather than Al-Qaeda, will be the trigger to American closure. The second big question, I submit, is what is this rising power's aims? How stable is the current regime? It seems as though Deng Xiaoping won the argument, and that there is no dispute in China that the only way, only direction to go is the direction it's taken in the last 25 years. Not so. There is an extraordinarily lively intellectual and political argument in China, which only close China watchers, it seems to me, ever get a handle on, and which doesn't actually surface enough in our discussion in the West. It is perfectly possible, and there are people who argue it in China, that it should actually stop the clock and actually reassert, if not Maoism, at least actually radical egalitarianism leavened by the Maoist experiment and experience of it. Will this rising power carry on rising? If you believe Goldman Sachs and others, China is set to be, alongside Brazil, Russia, and India, half of the world economy in 2040, with China the single biggest element of that. Can we extrapolate the last 25 years of 10% growth for the next 25 years? Is this country's exports going to move from $750 billion last year, they're going to double in the next 5 years, as they doubled in the last 5 years, to $1.5 trillion? Are they going to double again to $3 trillion, double again to $5 trillion or more by 2020? Until China's exports constitute not half, not two-thirds, but actually all the feasible merchandise exchanges in the world in 2030, 2040? I think not, but there are those who would dispute that point. And does it offer a model of economic development that actually other less developed countries should follow? Big questions, huge questions, and let's now kind of try and unpack them. The Chinese model, what's driven this growth? Well, high investment has accounted for 70% of GDP growth. China exports over, invests over 40% of GDP, around 45% of GDP. The World Bank says for the last 20 years that's accounted for 70% of the of Chinese growth. 25%, say the World Bank, is about labor migration. There has been the biggest labor migration in history. There are 116 million migrant workers officially living in Chinese urban areas. Unofficially, the figure is reckoned to top 150 million. That is account. So cheap labor moving into these cities and towns, driven along by this phenomenal investment, has been what's driven Chinese growth. The World Bank say that only 5%, I repeat, 5% is about the application of skills and the application of new technologies. This has been an act of political will, mobilizing savings on a scale never before seen in the history of mankind, with a migration of people never before seen in the history of mankind. But it's got not much to do with innovation or upskilling. State-owned banks have channeled these savings into the investment. They've been the absolute pivot on which the whole thing has turned. Add in Deng Xiaoping's price freedoms and the very clever way in which the Chinese organized price liberalization in the 1980s and 90s, not falling into the trap that actually the Soviet Union fell into and some countries in Eastern Europe. Add in openness. China has $600 billion of foreign direct investment who provided its astonishing exports. 70% of Chinese exports are produced in China by non-indigenous Chinese companies. That again is an extraordinary number, much higher than anywhere in Asia, much higher than Indonesia, double Indonesia, three times that of the Philippines. You know, there's nowhere else which has such a high proportion of its exports. The only near rival is Singapore. This country has relied on the Taiwanese, Hong Kong money. That's half the FDI. The other half comes from Japan, Western Europe, and North America to drive its export growth. It has not come from indigenous Chinese enterprise. That's the model. And it's been actually, in some respects, it's not been difficult to do, actually. It wasn't hard to see that price liberalization was what to do. It wasn't hard to see that opening an era of globalization would actually bring these results. And it was not hard to see that directing savings on this scale into investment would actually produce a growth rate. And it would not hard to see that actually cheap labor was an enormous asset in the era of globalization. And however, it was required enormous political suppleness by Deng Xiaoping to win the arguments, particularly in the 80s. And I regard him as one of the great figures of the 20th century, right up there with a Roosevelt or a Churchill, a state builder, a reformer, a brilliant politician, and a superb strategist. And again, there's not, to my knowledge at least, one sustained quality biography in English of Deng Xiaoping. Sign, actually, as I did this research, I'm going to read the research that actually Philip Schneider provided for me. I got it quite alarmed, really, by actually the paucity, the poverty of our knowledge of China. The United States has made a bigger investment than we have, but the number of the quality writers and quality knowledge of China in Britain is not as good as it should be. In fact, I think it's poor. Why is savings so high? Savings is so high because rural China is fantastically insecure. One part of it is the unintended consequence of the one-child policy. It had a huge impact on the Chinese peasant. Must save. Another inducement is that in the countryside, there is effectively, apart from a kind of rudimentary health system, there is virtually no social security system, and education, of course, but primary level, has to be paid for by peasant families, and they save, and they save. There is no pension in retirement. And it's those savings that actually have been taken by the great state-owned banks and driven into the skyscrapers that you see in the Shanghai skyline, and those motorway rings that you see around Beijing, and poured into China's state-owned enterprises. And what's happened, of course, is that rural China's incomes have actually lagged behind those in the city. Tony Saich at Harvard now estimates, if you count migrant workers as one properly should in this calculation, not as the Chinese do, as one-fifth of a person, but as a whole person in the income statistics, the Gini coefficient is 0.49. And that's devastatingly high for a country that purports to be egalitarian and purports to be equal. That's kind of inequality of the kind you see in Latin America, and the site you see in the worst examples in Africa. And it is fueling increasing and exponentially growing protest in China from peasants. And never forget that six of the last Chinese imperial regimes fell because of a peasant revolt. And I submit that Mao and the communists should be seen in the context of a 20th century peasant revolt rather than something distinct. And I think there are more parallels with the way in which an emerging communist class, analogous to the old Confucian gentry, is emerging in this highly centralized state. Countries like Britain, I note, revert to the mean. We've not managed to abolish our private schools, and our almost in any circumstance, even the 45-51 government couldn't do it. And civilizations and cultures are bloody hard to move, and the Chinese have got much more in common in 2006 with Imperial China and its Confucian system than the communists certainly would like to recognize. But if you are Hu Jintao, you certainly know that story, and you are observing growing peasant revolt, and it's not a surprise that actually the government have actually accented a harmonious economic development as a priority in the plan that's just beginning, trying to shelter rural incomes from tax and trying to invest substantially in boosting rural welfare. But the fulcrum on which the Chinese system turns is its banking system. $3.7 trillion worth of loans, nearly 200% of GDP, have been advanced by China's banks. $2 trillion to state and enterprises. And they are the, without that control of that banking system, the Chinese miracle would not have happened. But the Chinese banks are, I mean, the men who run them are appointed by the Communist Party. Like every other state enterprise in China, there's a committee of the Communist Party that actually effectively holds the management to account to make sure that the bank is doing the party wishes. There are no system of credit control, as we would understand it in the West. Credit is not allocated to profitable enterprise. It's actually allocated to the pecking order of enterprise decided by the party around national plan priorities. And it's used actually to produce the political fixes that the party wants. They nearly went bust, the banks, in 1998 because so many of the loans were non-performing. There's been a radical program to refinance them, those loans. The banks are now back on allegedly an even keel. An attempt has been made to improve their management. Three of the big four state banks, not the Agricultural Bank of China, which is legendarily inefficient and corrupt, have had stakes bought in them by foreign investors in an attempt actually to improve the internal management systems. But actually, everyone who knows the Chinese banking system well knows how deep-seated the problem is. 300,000 people in the Chinese construction bank don't actually change their spots in 2 or 3 years any more than you expect the faculty at LSE to do so. Cultures don't move that fast in any institution. And the notion that there's been a kind of radical change in lending practices is, I think, nonsensical. Richard Padera, writing a working paper for the IMF just last month, actually makes precisely this point, acknowledging the changes that have attempted to be made in China, but saying that actually the way business has been done in the past is exactly the same way as business is being done at the moment and probably in the future. This morning, Ernst & Young published their estimate of non-performing loans, $900 billion worth, against the official figure, which is under $300 billion worth. If those loans were recognized, the capital of the Chinese banking system would be eliminated, and the Chinese banks would be bust, and the system would stop. To give you some other numbers, the World Bank estimates that of the $2 trillion that have been lent to state enterprises, and as you'll learn, state enterprises are themselves bust, despite the attempts at reforming them, if the Chinese growth rate was to slow from 10% to 8%, or Chinese interest rates were to rise from the current 5.25% to 7.25%, 40 to 70% of those loans, of the $2 trillion worth of loans to state enterprises, would become non-performing. China's miracle depends on a bust banking system. And a slowdown in growth or a rise in Chinese interest rates will actually take the Chinese banks into the same dire circumstances they were in at the end of the 1990s. Because the assets to which they lend are those in state-owned enterprises, which constitute still one-third of GDP. These were the cradle-to-grave enterprises set up under Mao, and which are the vehicles for industrialization in China. One in three employees of state enterprises are reckoned to be idle. A huge effort has been made the last 5 years to radically improve their productivity. 16 million workers in state-owned enterprises have been laid off. But the productivity on average in state enterprises, and I need to just take this figure in, is 4% of that in the United States of America. Now, in the Friedrich Hayek lecture, Andrew Neil talked about the enormous growth in privatization in China. There hasn't been privatization in China. What there has been restructuring, merger, corporatization of these enterprises, and then a floating of a minority of their shares on the Shenzhen and Shanghai stock markets, and 81% of the equity remains in either provincial or state government control. Often indirectly, often at arm's length, even the OECD has been fooled into thinking that there's been much more privatization in China than has taken place. Of 6,000 restructured state-owned enterprises, not only does the Communist Party committee remain in every single one of them, but the members of those Communist Party committees have migrated, 70% of them just migrated, to become directors of the state enterprises that have been restructured. Their profitability is negligible, and they rely, as they always have done, on bank credit to get by. Some wonderful work being done by a man called Edward Steinfeld at MIT, who spent a lot of time in the mid-90s with three state-owned steel companies, and tells the story of how Megang, well, all of them actually, but Megang was a company that was floated on the Hong Kong stock market, allegedly privatized. Of course, the majority control remained with the state. They paid dividends and paid themselves extravagant sums of money, hired workers, but all off the back of bank credit taken on by the final holding company back in China that ultimately couldn't sustain it and went bust and had to be bailed out, guess what, by state-owned banks. That is, and that is still the story of China, because party control has to remain of banks and has to remain of state enterprises. This is Leninist corporatism that we're watching. This is not a free market economy that's developing. The Communist Party is insistent that it will remain in control of this economy. The private sector, which properly defined still is only one-fifth or less of one-fifth of Chinese GDP, is actually essentially either run by ex-party officials. Two-thirds of private enterprises in China are run by ex-state enterprise officials, most of whom are members of the party. One-third of people who started entrepreneurs in China have actually joined the party in order to get close to the people who give you the contracts upon which your business depends. And we can see this, actually, internationally. China's been growing at nearly 10% per annum since 1978. It's now 2006. You in this audience are people who are necessarily interested in China. Now reflect. The Japanese growth rate began in 1947, 30 years on, or more or less 30 years on, to the mid-1970s. If I'd asked a room like this to name five Japanese brands, you'd have named Honda, you'd have named Sony, you'd have talked about Toyota, you'd have been using, you'd have known about Mitsubishi and all the others. Name five international Chinese brands. And you can't, because they don't exist. If you talk about the top 500 world enterprises by turnover, amazingly, only about five or six are, I think eight actually, are Chinese. This is an economy which has grown by 10% per annum in nearly 30 years. The largest multinational is a wireless manufacturer called Huawei, based in Guangdong province in the south of China, set up by a guy who left the Red Army in the mid-1990s. It's financed by, yes, a $10 billion loan from the Chinese Construction Bank, and actually to sell wirelesses in lots of provinces around wireless equipment, Wi-Fi, around China. It's had to give as a quid pro quo, and we don't know, equity to provincial governments and indeed even the state government. It's almost certainly controlled by some combination of provincial governments, the PLA and Beijing. And that's the biggest one. The list is, there's a long list of successful private enterprises who have been asked by the party to actually take over a bankrupt company because that would suit the party interests and have subsequently gone bust. As a result, in In 2006, the incremental capital output ratio is worse than it was in the year that Mao died. One of additional incremental investment yields less additional output than it did under Mao. This is the most inefficient economy probably in the world. It has endemic corruption. Huang Gang, an economist who I enormously admire for his bravery, Tsinghua University and advises the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, estimates that corruption in China is 16% of Chinese GDP. And it's unbelievable, the scale of corruption. It's provincial governors, it's key people in the National People's Congress, it's bankers, it's extraordinary. It's as if the chief executives of all our banks and the Speaker in the House of Commons, most people running our local authorities, had all in the recent past been done for corruption. Environmental degradation in China is unbelievable. 660 cities suffer from some form of water pollution. 400,000 people a year die of air pollution. It's an innovation disaster. Just take one area, software. China has much more internet. It has 530 technologists, scientists, software writers per million inhabitants compared with 170 per million in India. Yet, despite the fact it's got three times proportionately more computer engineers and software writers, despite the fact its internet penetration is four times that of India, India's software production is $8 billion compared with China's $6 billion. And China manages to export how much? Only $400 million worth, less than 10%. India exports three-quarters of all its software output. It's got 98% of China's high-tech exports are made by non-Chinese companies, 98%. Its productivity, I remind you, is 4% of that in the United States. This is China that's coming to eat you up for breakfast. This is the China that Gordon Brown says that is the big challenge in globalization. This is the China which the Americans want to protect themselves from. China is a country in which has done a lot, but my God, has got a lot to do. And it relies on that reserve army, its huge savings, and that indifference to inequality. And that foreign direct investment, which is so high, in my view, is a sign of weakness, not strength. What's wrong? Well, what's wrong, and here I've made an intellectual journey, and some of you know my work, will know it well, I hope, my basic thesis, is that in just the same way that I argue in Britain that actually the soft institutional infrastructure, corporate governance, short-termism, lack of duty of care to workforces, madness to make assets sweat hard, is actually counterproductive in a market economy, and actually, in a sense, the kind of free market neoconservative view of how you do capitalism is enormously destructive because it doesn't take into account the soft institutional infrastructure. Interestingly, Marxism, coming actually from the same principles of political economy as free market economics, Ricardian roots, actually has the same kind of view that actually you can just see enterprise as a black box in which inputs turn into outputs in a highly transactional way. Not true. I've come to understand, writing this book and reflecting on why it was that Europe took over China in the 19th century. And remember, you know, as late as 1700, China was making more iron than Europe. Chinese inventions were hundreds of years ahead of those of us in Europe. Why did it not turn on into self-sustaining growth? And the answer I've come round to believing is that actually the Enlightenment institutional infrastructure that we take for granted in the West, and by that I mean not just representative government, I mean a free press, I mean free trade unions, I mean independent law, independent judiciary, independent competition authorities, independent audit, independent universities, that we just assume as part of our landscape are actually central to the operation of a market economy, and they don't exist in China because they can't exist in China. And that's why the lack of accountability, the lack of pluralism, the lack of multiple experimentation is ultimately because, in my view, China has not developed as intriguingly Japan has begun to, as intriguingly Taiwan is doing, as Hong Kong possesses, a soft institutional infrastructure that actually will drive its enterprise to the next level. That is the crisis facing the Chinese Communist Party, and the best and brightest in the party know it. This can't continue. China can't continue as it has continued the last 25 years. Why? Because you can't waste capital on this scale, because you can't rely on rural incomes lagging behind those in the cities and to this degree of inequality, because exports cannot carry on rising at the rate they have. The logic of big numbers just sets in. Just think about it. 750 billion last year to 1.5 trillion exports in 2010, the world's biggest exporter forecast here, OECD, doubles again to 2015, 3 trillion, doubles again 2020, 6 trillion. Merchandise exports, world merchandise exports in 2005 were $7.5 trillion. They grow around 5-6% per annum. You know, at some stage in the 2020s, China's exports would be all that was in the world of world trade. That's not going to happen. China's exports growth must slow down. That means that it's a capacity. It's got $1 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves because it's determined to hold the renminbi at the current level to keep its exports competitive. I submit that actually it can't carry on doing that because one day the dollar will fall and the renminbi will rise, the general consensus by 30%, which means as soon as that happens, the Chinese will lose the 30% of the value of their foreign exchange reserves. And that is $300 billion. That's big potatoes. And when it starts to be, and if they carry on like this, they'll have $2 trillion worth of foreign exchange reserves. And when then they'd lose $600 billion when the currency adjustment comes. They can't carry on acquiring reserves like this, nor can they carry on insulating the domestic money supply from the fact that they're acquiring reserves like this. Money supply growth is running at nearly double-digit numbers in China, and they're going to have to put up interest rates, already have begun to, in order to contain the growth of money supply. If they do that, they slow the economy down. They slow the economy down, that puts those loans at risk in the state-owned banks. But by the way, they're in a catch-22. If they allow the renminbi to go up, that means the rural incomes will go down because food prices are pegged to world prices because China's joined the World Trade Organization. And that means that the savings, in my view, can't continue at the current rate. Savings in rural China will start to fall. So there will be a rebalancing in China. Exports will fall to more normal levels. Consumption will rise to more normal levels. And the Chinese will build enterprises that actually can meet domestic demand. But to do that requires the establishment of a soft institutional infrastructure that I've described, and what a threat that is to the Chinese Communist Party. International communism was no more on December the 25th, 1991, when Gorbachev resigned as president of the Soviet Union. And it became obvious that the idea that communism was a global movement, a coming movement, a future movement, was now disproved by the march of events. And actually the party has been struggling with how to kind of ideologically construct something which makes sense of the place they're in. Hence the migration from trying to build a socialist economy to a socialist market economy. Hence Jiang Zemin's three representing all advanced forces in China, all classes in China, and all cultures in China. The point to become a national party because class war is declared over. Nah. But if class war is over, what's the justification of the dictatorship of the proletariat? And if you're as bright as the senior members of the Chinese Communist Party, it is really hard to come up with a satisfactory answer why your party does not have to hold itself periodically to account in elections. There is a kind of deep, in my view, psychological corruption of members of the party, which is revealed in the systemic because they know that actually what was required in the revolution in the 1940s is not required in the bureaucratic world of the 1990s and 2000s. And the debates within the party are becoming more and more urgent. I just put this thought to you. I floated it in the book. It was the fifth generation of Soviet leaders who came to terms with the fact that actually communism didn't work operationally in the Soviet Union, and didn't intellectually and ideologically work either. And the implosion came from within. I submit that the fifth generation of Chinese communist leaders, who will take over between 2010 and 2012, are likely to come to similar conclusions. And there is Tiananmen. I mean, Tiananmen was not just in China, Beijing. It was in at least 181 cities. Arthur Laysom's Tiananmen papers say that the party itself acknowledges that there were Tiananmen-scale revolts in 181 cities in China. And the fight was for democracy, the fight was for corruption, the fight was for some people, more liberalization. It was a rum coalition, one of the easy ways that actually the party managed to quell it. But Deng Xiaoping relied upon his personal support of the 28th and 29th Army groups to come into Beijing from the south of China in order to quell that rebellion. Hu Jintao, who has not commanded the army personally during the revolution, has no such personal loyalties in which he can count on if actually there was a similar type conflagration today. If the growth stopped, I think that there would be enormous problems in China, and the fallback would be nationalism. And you can see this already. The party is has worked up its worked up patriotism as the card it plays. It squares up to the Japanese over the Senkuku Islands in the East China Sea. It's building up its forces in Taiwan there. Some say already, everyone says between 5 and 10 years, the character of the Chinese military will be able to launch an assault on Taiwan and reintegrate the country which has a temerity to call itself the Republic of China back into the People's Republic of China. Hu Jintao reminds anyone who cares to listen how preoccupied he is with the Malacca question, that four-fifths of China's oil flows through the Malaccan Straits between Indonesia and Malaysia. The deputy chief of staff has called for China to develop a blue navy in order to protect Chinese tankers on the high seas. And the Americans' investment in their fleet, 281 ships, more than the next 17 nations combined, the naval effort in the Indian Ocean and in the Pacific is entirely focused at demonstrating to the Japanese that they are a solid ally, and that if there was an invasion of Taiwan, they would respond aggressively, which is why the Chinese are building up submarines and missiles that are only designed to take on American carrier groups when they sail to Taiwan to relieve the putative invasion. These are all cards that if the Communist Party is forced back into closure by the West closing to China, may decide to play. I put it at no more than a 5 or 10% risk, but nobody can exclude the chance of a invasion of Taiwan, and no one can exclude the risk of a regional war in Asia as a result. That would be de facto the Third World War. Please don't think that's a silly thing to say, because we've had 60 years of peace. The history of humanity is not sustained periods of peace. It is interludes of war. And if there is one, this is where it self-evidently will come, between the number one world power of the United States, the number two economic power, Japan, and the power that will overtake Germany to become the number three economic power, China, within 5 years. And sometimes I'm amazed by actually the kind of August 1914 feel to this part of the world. when the Japanese decided they were going to make sure that the sovereignty of the Senkuku Islands, which is central to the oil and gas reserves under the East China Sea, and they sent a small naval flotilla to take it over. 2 months later, the Chinese issued an ultimatum to Japan, saying it had to withdraw or take the consequences. And then some months later, sent a 5-strong naval force, including a nuclear destroyer. Both sides backed off, both sides looking for a settlement, but this is not the language that Europeans actually kind of understand. Now, how is America going to react to this? I mean, there is the House of Representatives, which just passed this extraordinary piece of legislation about treatment of American immigrants. There was extraordinary row over Dubai Port Authority taking over 6 American ports. Over 400 congressmen and women, and only 13 voted for the Chinese National Oil Corporation being able to buy Unocoal last year. There are 20 anti-China bills in the House of Representatives and the Senate. There is the tradition of the Atlantic Charter and the kind of Rooseveltian Truman tradition that built the post-war economic and political institutions has completely evaporated. We have watched the last 20 years in the United States of America, the rise of a highly conservative United States, the assertion of the kind of Jacksonian kind of tradition in American politics, which says it's foreigners who are to blame for our ills, in particular for the declining middle, which is the kind of permanent and the rise of economic insecurity in America. And those of you who know the states well, I mean, there's Lou Dobbs, CNN, you know, protesting about American how the Chinese are taking away American jobs on his daily program on CNN. And, you know, listen to any of the radio talk show hosts about the way they feel about imports from China. And, of course, there's a problem. Last year, $240 billion worth of Chinese exports were imported in the United States of America, only $38 billion fell the other way. The resulting trade deficit of $202 billion was a record bilateral trade deficit in America's history. Absolutely and proportionally a record, much bigger than anything that took place when Japan was on the rise in the 1980s. But then, of course, the Americans had the interest in building up Japan as a liberal capitalist power. What interest have they in building up a communist power that is actually competing with them for oil resources around the world and is actually, as the Department of Defense says, the one power that could take on the Americans militarily? But yet, the Americans rely on China. It is Chinese, the buildup of Chinese foreign exchange reserves is what finances the American trade deficit. But interestingly, here's the point. China's got $1 trillion worth of, it's got $750 worth of foreign exchange reserves, it's going to rise to $1 trillion this year. It's only allowed, the Americans are happy for it to buy bonds and bills. But if the Chinese try to say, well, look, you know, we want to diversify the bonds and bills because we want to buy some earning assets, we want to buy a company, we'd like to buy some land, it's uproar. I mean, the Chinese, I mean, this is an amazing number. The Chinese may have $6 billion worth of foreign exchange that's rising to $1 trillion. But there's only reckoned to be $20 billion worth investment in kind of factories and underlying assets in the States, which is just tiny. Just tiny. And if they're trying to build that up, we can imagine what the reaction in the States will be. So, what must the West do? How must the West react to China's rise in the global era? Well, my view is unambiguous that we must stay open. This is not an economy which is going to come and eat us for breakfast. This is an economy which, with profound difficulties and which faces a very difficult transition in the next 5 or 10 years. We must not blame globalization for economic insecurity. The Americans do a survey every 2 years of all mass layoffs in the States. And what was the cause of those layoffs? Between 2001 and 2003, there were 970,000 layoffs in American factories employing more than 5,000 people. How many of those jobs do you think went to China? Well, then the answer is 8,000. That is not what Lou Dobbs says, and that is not what the talk show hosts say. That's not what the American Congress thinks. And it's the same story here. A globalization, these trade flows so far, you know, are not the cause of the economic insecurity. As I argue in the book, if you want to understand why America has got a declining middle and there's rising economic insecurity, you look at these numbers and there is one thing which screams at you. Between 1995 and 2005, the United States cumulatively had $9 trillion worth of mergers and takeovers. And consequent upon that was an enormous amount of downsizing and economic rationalization. Economic insecurity is made in the USA, not made in China. And the same story is true in Europe and in Britain. We must be confident that China is not coming to get us. In fact, what our line on China should be is to understand their achievement, but to really understand the problems they've got, and to recognize that what they've got to do and what will happen in China anyway as the kind of momentum of the reform program works its way through is they will have to construct the economic and political pluralism and an Asian-style soft institutional infrastructure which will permit their enterprise to start raising its levels of productivity and innovation up to Asian levels, let alone European and American levels. That's where they've got to go. And that's what will happen in China. And our job in the West is to help them do it and to stay open while they do it and not to talk the language of closure and protection and war. And we in the West must reaffirm our commitment to what I call Enlightenment values and our commitment to a rules-based international system, the legacy of the Atlantic Charter. And that is a fight actually for a reason. That is a fight for stem cell research. It's a fight against creationism. It's a fight to accept that capitalism is about interplay between hard processes, free markets, free movement of prices, flexible wages, incentives, profit motive, but soft institutional structures as well. Attention to corporate governance, duty of care to workforces, attacks on monopoly power in the private sector. And above all, there's a duty of care to workforces who should not actually be treated as disposable commodities by people merging in New York as they do in London, because our companies are merged as much and are taken over as they are in the States. And that is actually where, if we have a disaffected working class in Britain voting BNP, look there and not to China. We have to recognize that actually, in the same way to fight for Enlightenment values and the soft institutional infrastructures at home, we have to fight for them abroad. We have to support the fight for human rights in China. It's a central part of the Chinese story. We have to insist that actually, in the so-called fight against terrorism, that the British government does not actually get the wrong trade-off between liberty and control. We have to insist that international rules of the game hold, which is why I'm such an admirer of David's work, because that's the core of David's argument. And although I was ferociously against the war against Iraq, because without a second UN resolution, it was an illegal war, breaking the Enlightenment institutional infrastructure upon which the West's kind of appeal and legitimacy stands, and an illegal war cannot actually turn into a successful occupation or a successful reconstruction as we are seeing. But having got there, I strongly believe that we can only leave if we leave a institutional kind of infrastructure which gets as close as we can to delivering to Iraqis what we would want to see in China, what we intend to uphold in our own countries. So for my money, that's the writing on the wall. And if you don't read it, if you don't hear its conclusions, the risks are evident. They are of America putting 27% tariffs on Chinese imports, Chinese diverting those exports to Europe, Europe responding with its tariffs, and the beginnings of the kind of trade war that we saw in the early 1930s, with all the consequences for the integrity of the financial system and economic prosperity. We'll see depression. We could even see, as a consequence of that, a beleaguered, enclosed Chinese Communist Party actually embarking upon the war in Asia that I've talked upon. The writing is on the wall. Those are the contemporary global risks, in my view. There are options. We just have to take the right ones. Thank you very much.
Well, I know some of you, especially students, have to go. And if you do have to go, perhaps you'll just disappear now. And then the rest of us can settle down to some questions. We've got half an hour for that. I generally take questions in clusters of four or five, if you've been to Miliband lectures before, because then the audience has a chance to hear what's on the mind of the audience, as well as the speaker have a chance to engage with some critical issues. So I want to take a cluster of questions. But first, let me say I thought that was a tour de force. I first wanted to use the academic term, wow. It was an extremely impressive narrative, and a narrative which busts a lot of and attacks a lot of conventional wisdom about China. And it's certainly in tension with the dominant commentaries on China in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere. And I particularly like the way Will drives his argument toward a series of fundamental conclusions about the need for openness, tough multilateralism, and so on, the conclusions he reached towards the end, which seemed to me an entirely original and distinctive way of defending what are very fragile global institutions. But I'm delighted now to take questions. There are mics around to pick your voices up. So, please. Gentleman at the front.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm David Meffham from the Institute for Public Policy Research. Will, thanks very much indeed for that lecture. As David said, you covered a huge amount of ground there, and there's lots of very important issues that were raised. I want to raise just one issue around what was really the main focus of your lecture, the Chinese economic model. And you brilliantly kind of deconstructed the strengths and weaknesses of that model. But despite many weaknesses that you referred to, China has succeeded, as you said in your lecture, in lifting something like 280 million people out of acute poverty in, I think, the last two decades. So despite all the failures, they must be doing something right. And I'm interested to know what you think the lessons might be for other parts of the world from the Chinese experience in terms of their development progress. I mean, at the same time as China's been proceeding very rapidly economically, other parts of the world, not least Africa, have been falling behind. Certainly large parts of Africa have been falling behind. Are there some positive lessons from the Chinese experience that African reformers and African countries ought to be embracing and thinking about in terms of their own development agenda?
Thank you. The BRIC report, Goldman Sachs.
You have to keep the mic close to you. Yeah.
The Goldman Sachs BRIC report. Now, do you think it's an exercise in naivety, or does it have some other motives? I mean, you just visit Holy.
We didn't quite grasp the question,
BRIC,
actually.
The BRIC report.
Do you mind just reformulating it?
Yeah.
Okay. Do it again, but with the microphone.
Well, I think I...
No, don't look at anyone. Just look at the microphone and talk into it.
Now, what I'm asking you is the BRIC report of Goldman Sachs is it simply an exercise in naivety, or has it some motives? Because it has been very influential. It has, in what you call in developing countries, it has leveled the opposition against the globalization, and I think it has also some effect on the developed countries as well. So yes, is it simply an exercise in naivety, or it has some motives?
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Great. Woman in front of you.
Hi, my name's Helen McCarthy. I'm a PhD student at the School of Advanced Study. For me, your very frightening sketch of the likely consequences should a war break out with Taiwan came to me as something of a thunderclap in the middle of what was otherwise a ultimately quite optimistic prognosis as to how the West might deal with China. I mean, given that we saw with what respect the international community, or rather America and its allies, treat institutions of global governance and the rule of international law, as in the case of Iraq, should we feel confident that in the event of a war, Third World War starting in Taiwan, that the UN will save us, and that we can stand by the Enlightenment values will be upheld?
Gentleman there, yeah.
Thank you. You correctly say, in my opinion, that the key to ensuring long-term growth in China is boosting consumption and moving away from exports and investment. What measures do you think the Chinese government should introduce to achieve this?
Are there any signs that dissent amongst the rural poor is coalescing into any kind of political movement, as we saw at the end of the 80s?
Yeah, well, we'll take a sixth, a final one in this cluster.
I would like to know if you think that we are helping China on its headlong path to your proposed destruction by selling it a lot of our own industry, our electronics products, our car industry, and possibly many others that I haven't heard of, are being sold to Chinese entrepreneurs, and just helping them on their path to destruction that you have described.
Will.
Can I stand up?
Yeah, stand
further.
Up.
Yes. Some very good questions, and I hope I can manage to kind of answer satisfactorily. I'll just take them in the order they were asked, actually, and I'll be quick too, because otherwise the next round of questions won't get through. What lessons from the Chinese development experience? I think the two are, one, the role of the banking system in canalising savings into investment. That was done on a grand scale in Japan in the 50s and 60s. It was done earlier by the Germans in the 1880s and 1890s, and the Chinese have learned that lesson, and I think they've carried it too far because they had not embedded proper creditworthiness approaches in the banking system. But I mean, what it means, I would say that don't use capital markets, use institutions like banks. That's one big lesson. And the second big lesson, and it's the big issue compared with India, is the advantage of openness. I mean, I think they've Deng Xiaoping saw that, you know, what an opportunity globalization was, and by having this kind of open, they've got extraordinary low tariffs to imports of Chinese. And it really is an open market. Although, you know, the different provinces of China have got all kinds of barriers. So you can get in to province A, but actually the barriers between province A and province B are often much more acute than between either province and the rest of the world. So the lessons I take away from it are openness and use your banking system. Was the Goldman Sachs report naivety? Look, the Goldman Sachs spot are kind of really deeply into China. I mean, it's there. They sponsor the Three Emperors exhibition. It's their man who was the author of now works at Goldman Sachs, who come up with the idea of the Beijing Consensus, and they really are quite close to the Chinese government, because of course they see lots of investment banking opportunities brokering purchases by foreigners of equity in Chinese enterprises. It's not naivety, I mean they position themselves as an organisation which is very friendly to China. And actually this is one of the problems. I don't know whether at Christmas Sir John Bond, who's chairman of HSBC, edited the Today programme for, you know, these guest editors, and he was editor of the Today programme for a day, for a morning, and he himself put himself up for interview. And what I find was a quintessential expression of a kind of Goldman Sachs or Western Banker view of China, which is, look, you know, essentially there's a kind of Maslow hierarchy of needs, and you know, when so many people are yet to be get to basic subsistence, please don't talk the language of, you know, human rights and enlightened institutions. Let's talk economics and not politics. Essentially, you know, precisely the line that actually the party likes businessmen to talk, and Goldman Sachs talk that language. In fact, of course, my argument is that, you know, HSBC are they own a fifth of the Bank of Telecommunications. That's China's fifth biggest bank. There's some lawsuits in Shandong province where the Bank of Telecommunications has been involved in for some years, trying actually to make the collateral they took on some loans stick. But of course, it's not in the party interest for that to happen. And so these bad loans are being carried by the Bank of Telecommunications, and you know, HSBC faces some very substantial write-offs. And what I try to say to the likes of John Bond is, don't you understand, you A1 fool, that that the battle for a freedom of the press, for free trade unionism, for human rights, is exactly the same as your battle to have an independent court system that actually works and gives adjudication in commercial disputes fairly, and not round a retired colonel from the PLA taking his instructions from the provincial party boss, because that's actually what the party think is right in XYZ province. Your battle is the same. And actually for China to get from where it is to where it needs to be, actually it's got to move on all these fronts simultaneously. So I think there is a degree of naivety by Goldman Sachs. On the point about Taiwan, can the UN sort it out? I made my point at the beginning, and I begin the book by saying it is a truth universally acknowledged that one great power never voluntarily cedes pride of place to another, balderizing Jane Austen. These two great powers, the United States and China, are capable of actually facing up to one another in war and actually not actually taking the mediation of the United Nations at all. I personally think that actually the United States has a policy of studied ambiguity on Taiwan. It is not actually an overt treaty which says if ever there's an invasion, we'll definitely come to your aid. It's left much more kind of hazy by a kind of protocol that was organized in 1979 by Deng. One of the first things Deng did, actually, Deng said, look, you know, if we're going to globalize, I mean, that we've got to come to a settlement with the United States. That means that we've got to come to some agreement over Taiwan. If they'll kind of not, we'll promise not to invade it, and kind of some form of words which says, you know, we accept that, you know, pro tem, it's going to have its current status. If the United States will actually make it ambiguous whether or not it will defend Taiwan, and that's been the kind of settlement since then. And I actually think that one of the interesting consequences of Iraq is that actually the American military will be much more cautious about getting into these wars than it would have been hitherto. And actually, it's really interesting. It's why the Iranian situation, if you think about Iran for a minute, because it all connects in these days. The reason why Iran can take the line it does is it knows that actually there won't be any American military intervention in Iran. Why? Because the immediate consequence would be the Iranian army would actually move into Iraq. It couldn't do it legally because there's such a big oil supply deal between Iran and China that UN on the China on the Security Council have said, like they said over Sudan, that actually there'll be no military action against Iran. So knowing, and anyway, if the Americans have stuff all that, we'll move in into Iran. actually that would be the opportunity that China would have to move on Taiwan. And we know, as a consequence, that America is so constrained on Iran that it can do not very much. And actually the Iranians know that, which is why they can build their nuclear reactors and all the rest of it, which is why actually the Middle Eastern situation is so dangerous at the moment. Because the Israelis may take the situation into their own hands. It all connects in 2006. And we need actually to reaffirm the principles of the United Nations. We need actually to kind of reorganize the UN Security Council. We need to have we need to get at least the Japanese. We need to kind of open up the G8 so that we get kind of it becomes a proper change agent to reorganising the UN. But my ideas on this are much less interesting than David's, and I'm going to talk to him about all this over supper later and give you a better answer after that. On the consumption question, how to promote consumption? Well, I mean, I think that the there's a kind of catch between two here. One way is I think promote consumption is being two things, and this is why it's so difficult. One, I think you have to put in place property rights against which you can lend, and two, you have to put in place a social security system that makes people think that they don't have to save for their old age at quite the same rate they're doing. Now, at the moment, I mean, the best you can do in China, very interesting, by the way, you made the point about poverty in China. The big reduction of this poverty in China came not actually over the 80s and 90s. The big reduction in poverty came between 1979 and 1985, when the communes, 26,000 communes that Mao set up, just imploded in a very brief period of time. It is one of the most extraordinary periods in world history, in my view. 530 million peasants left communes and started farming plots of land within a 3 or 4 year period. And agricultural productivity really boosted, and there was a big reduction in poverty. Now, one thing that's interesting is, and I always put this question, is that what plots of land do you think 530 million peasants returned to? And when I was in China, I just did my little kind of own, little jumping out of the minivan with a translator, and just spoke to about 31 peasants, just as I driving through and all 31 said, we farm the plots of our ancestors. And in Anhui province, which is where actually it all began in 1978, there's a professor of economic history at Tsinghua University, who actually, when I said, I think that property rights are very deeply embedded in China, I've never understood how the rolling back the communes could happen so fast if the peasants had not gone back to the plots of land their ancestors farmed. He said, well, it's obvious. Of course that's true. And of course, as you know, Douglas North won the Nobel Prize for Economic History in the early 1990s for saying that one of the things that the Chinese didn't have was any experience in property rights. I mean, it was the Chinese in 136 BC who established the first continental system of property rights. He brought in a kind of coffin and opened it, and these were all the titles to property that his research assistants had been gathering in Anhui province. But even though they farmed the lands of their ancestors, they can only do it on a 70-year lease. And one of the things that if you're going to get consumption, you're going to get people to drop their savings, you've got to get them to borrow against the value of some assets. The reason why there's such big low savings ratios in the United States and the United Kingdom is because property ownership is so widespread. So until the Chinese start giving property rights, we're not going to get it, and we're not going to get it unless we start building, a pension system, an education system, and a health system, and an unemployment system. But that means raising taxes. And you can't raise taxes because the legitimacy of the government is such that actually there would be revolt against it. And that's why to rebalance the Chinese economy requires the embrace of economic and political pluralism and requires the embrace of this institutional infrastructure. And that's why, and the party know this. I mean, most of the intellectuals I've talked to, either concede this point or make a different one, but they basically kind of get it, and that's where they are. Rural poor, political movement. Not yet. I mean, the only political movement that's of kind of any scale in China is actually amazing, Falun Gong. We've got 36 million adherents, and actually quite a lot of, interestingly, you find surprising people making recommendations to party cadres to join the Falun Gong. You know, quite senior in the party will say, I know that you can't believe in communism. You know, I know this place is a spiritual desert. You know, if you want some spirituality and some idealism, join the Falun Gong. And one reason why the party actually takes such a kind of repressive approach to the Falun Gong is because they see it as a menace. About 2,200 Falun Gong people who've been arrested have died in prison, largely not because they've been killed or tortured, but because they kind of they go on hunger strikes. But then if they haven't been in prison, they wouldn't have gone on the hunger strikes. So I guess you can play it however you like it. But that's the nearest there is to a kind of mass movement. But the growth of strikes is very marked. 4 million instances of 4 million workers went on strike in 2004. The working population is rather larger than that. There's kind of working population in the cities is over 300 million and 400 million on the land, so 4 million is a tiny proportion. But just think about going on strike in China. And a very brave thing to do. And the number of incidents of protests, 87,000. Which is kind of up from 74,000, up from 56,000 the last few years. Those are official numbers. I mean, the unofficial numbers are meant to be much higher. And there's around almost every city, there's instances where the party actually, confiscate land, and they're meant to give compensation to peasants, and peasants know what their property rights are, but they've only got these leases, and so they're given some crap compensation because they've got some crappy lease, and they say, this was our ancestors' land. We want proper compensation. And there's really big disputes over it, and you get real riot conditions over it. And actually, the courts are going to have to move and start giving decent arbitration, otherwise there is a danger of actually this kind of conflagration. What about something China, nonsensical clip from the West? Actually, the Chinese do very well, actually, out of this kind of dismantling assets in Western Europe and North America, shipping it back to China, reassembling it, and then exporting from that base. I mean, the numbers look great. And of course, they do it for the reasons that I've described in my lecture. For a lot of private enterprise, you can't get the state owned bank to give anyone money. You can't lose any money on the equity market. What you can do, though, is buy these assets at knockdown prices, actually capitalize on opportunity in a year or two, pay back your original investment, and then your quid's in. I mean, the average duration of a small private Chinese company is 3 years. Very transient. We might be saying them crap, they're voluntarily buying it, and the people who buy it actually are making a lot of money. And, that is actually a symptom of Chinese weakness, not Chinese strength. Thank you.
Well, we've only got 10 more minutes, and so perhaps there's time for just a couple more questions. Anyone at the top? No, okay. Mike over here, and then, we'll take very brief questions.
Okay. Could you perhaps explain what's the economic and the strategic value for both China and the U.S. with regards to Taiwan?
Did you get that?
Yep.
Okay, question about that. A model question, very brief, very short.
You describe, on the one hand, a traditional Confucian quasi-imperial China, and on the other hand, this kind of capitalist Wild East, where anything goes. And it seems a bit difficult, from here at least, to reconcile the two. Would you care to compare China with Singapore, which is also Confucian traditional and shows no, and a bit authoritarian, and shows no sign of collapsing?
And behind you.
I would just be very interested to know what you think about U.S. debt to China in terms of U.S. Treasury bonds and how it could be a weapon in case of, in the event of a conflict between the two countries.
I didn't quite catch that. It's quite clear, yeah.
Sorry. To what extent U.S. debt to China in the form of U.S. Treasury bonds could be a bargaining weapon in the event of a tension between the two countries.
Okay. Yep.
Any more? It's okay.
I think that's all we have.
Oh, yes, please. Chinese, I don't know if you're Chinese, but...
Actually, I'm Malaysian, but I've lived in London for 25 years, and until I went to China for a year last year, I didn't realize how biased British press was. Anyway, that's a comment. But what I wanted to say is, shouldn't we be grateful to China? Isn't China saving Gordon Brown's bacon? Is cheap imports propping up our economy?
Okay, well, I've got a couple of observations and questions myself.
Oh, you're my goodness.
So, one is to follow on David Meppen's question, what can be learned from China's developmental trajectory? It seems to me that your emphasis on openness is too broad, because what China has done, it has liberalized its trade while not liberalizing its financial markets and currency convertibility. It has followed a very particular path of selective and managed entry into the global economy over 2 to 3 decades. All developing countries that have liberalized their trade and financial institutions at one and the same time have done less well than those countries that have liberalized trade and only haltingly moved towards financial market liberalization. So it seems to me that is a very massive qualification and something we can learn from China. In addition, I would say, even within the framework of trade liberalization, tariff reduction in China, some of the biggest tariff reductions in China have come in the 1990s. 40% of tariff reductions were done in the mid-1990s. Why? Because the Chinese economic development path, the growth had already taken off. In other words, they enjoyed those industries and manufacturing bases, enjoyed some infant industry protection. So that's the second point I would make with regard to what can be learnt, among others. Quick point on why the fifth generation might be great reformers. It seems to me the fifth generation might be great reformers because they're being educated in Chinese universities now in a very broad pluralist and enlightenment tradition. I'm absolutely struck going to China by not only how smart Chinese young graduate students are, but how they read broadly, not in just their traditions, but in ours. Popper's in Chinese, Hayek's in Chinese, Rawls is in Chinese. We're in Chinese, for goodness sake. But some of the great liberal thinkers of the West and the Enlightenment are in Chinese. And the extraordinary thing is, of course, that they are increasingly schooled in our ways of thinking as well as their own, whereas we're not schooled in their ways of thinking. And that seems to me, you know, one of the greatest risks going forward in politics and international stability is that they are increasingly, young Chinese people today are increasingly learning from a diverse body of knowledge, European and non-European. So I think there is some intellectual liberalization going on. I think that's deliberate. That's absolutely deliberate, because you can't change a monolith like China overnight without huge instabilities and risks, not only to China, but to the region around China and perhaps even beyond that. And I think the Chinese authorities and the Communist Party understand well that liberalization in China must come steadily before maybe democratization comes later. And we should remember in the West, when we preach human rights and democracy, as I do in all my books and all my work, but we should all remember that the West liberalized first and became democratic second. Finally, my last comment is on China as a potentially aggressive power. Well, of course, Taiwan is the hot issue. If you look at Chinese use of its veto power in the United Nations since China became member of the Security Council, it's only used its veto power on very, very few occasions, and then mainly in connection with Taiwan. Compare that to Britain, France, and of course the United States. And it's a different level of involvement in global affairs by those powers. China has traditionally, historically, going back hundreds of years, been hesitant about expansion. After all, famously destroyed its navy, one of the greatest navies in the world, several centuries ago, because the emperor thought it unwise for China to expand and take some of the cultural risks that might entail. So I think, in a sense, looking forward, that Taiwan is, of course, a risk area, but China's got vested interests in economic stability, in maintaining stability in its own country. And although the nationalist card is powerful in China today, and no doubt will get more powerful later, China recognizes its global interdependence. The interdependence of the China's economy, the rest of the economy, and especially with the USA. Chinese leaders would be absolutely crazy to cross certain boundaries. And there's no evidence yet that they are. 3 points.
Very interesting.
You've got three minutes.
I'm kind of two-thirds of the way with you there. I do think
there's some things I disagree with. Now, there was a question on Taiwan. I've written down Taiwan. I can't remember what the question was. Mummy? Well, it's important for China strategically because it would give it port facilities which would allow it to have a serious Blue Ocean Navy, and that's what the Chinese say anyway. It's also, but it's much less. Again, I think people in the West don't kind of understand really how bitter and deep felt the reverses that China had in the 19th century were. I mean, they call it the century of humiliation, and by God, was it a humiliating century. I mean, from losing the Opium Wars to Britain in 1842, right up until the Japanese kind of occupied most of the nicest bits of China in 1937, it was actually, you know, reverse after reverse. 26 treaties were signed between, you know, and the Chinese and Western powers and Russia and Japan, in which, you know, they were at the wrong end of it. And they call it the century of humiliation. The Japanese invaded Taiwan, took it as a colony in 1895. And, you know, they've got Hong Kong back, they've got Macau back, but they haven't got Taiwan back. And you know, they feel it very bitterly that actually and what's interesting about Taiwan, of course, is that you know, after Chiang Kai-shek's death, it's begun to develop the kind of institutions which actually I think, and a lot of other people think, that actually mainland China needs. I mean, there is a rule of law in China. There's a free in Taiwan. There's a free press in China, in Taiwan. There's competitive elections in Taiwan. It's got a Chinese, indigenously constructed Chinese soft institutional infrastructure, and it works. And it's a kind of standing ideological reproach to what happens on the mainland. And reintegrating it into China removes this ideological threat and actually avenges the century of humiliation. And it's enormously potent in a Chinese context. And strategically, it's about, as I say, it's about having a kind of forward base in the Pacific, which I think that's kind of a secondary issue. The American interest in, what's American in defending it? Well, I don't get it, actually. I mean, there was an interest in defending it, I think between kind of 1947 and 1991, but actually I think that interest has kind of fallen away. And I'm not certain the Americans would defend it. Of course, the Japanese take a different approach. They take the approach that if the Chinese take over Taiwan, then actually, if they have Taiwan, you then have the enormous oil and gas reserves in the East China Sea. Because you draw a line from Taiwan up to South Island, Japan, through the Senkuku Islands, and that actually means that actually the Japanese can claim the Senkuku Islands and one of the world's great oil and gas reserves as Japanese. Once the Chinese have got Taiwan, that falls, and those oil and gas reserves fall unambiguously to China. And the Chinese think that they haven't got enough oil and gas reserves. They haven't, actually. And so that's another reason why they want Taiwan, as well as actually demonstrating that actually to the Chinese people that actually, you know, whatever you may think about communists, they bloody assert Chinese kind of interests. Singapore. And Singapore, this whole question of Confucianism, I mean, I've kind of backed and filled about Confucianism. I'm not certain that Singapore is particularly Confucian. I mean, those who know the Confucian system, you know, will know about the system of remonstrance and embedded checks and balances in the imperial court. In an all-foreign state like Singapore, city-state like Singapore, there's not many embedded checks and balances, and I don't know many Singaporean officials would bring their coffins to see Lee Kuan Yew as he was to protest about Singaporean policy, and if it was wrong, actually commit suicide or be sent to your death with your coffin, which was the tradition of Confucian officials in mainland China. there's, you know, Confucianism is, you know, often, I mean, the analects are rich, and you can actually, you know, almost construct whatever you like to prove that your system is Confucian. What I wanted to say about, and I, you know, 4 million Singaporeans and 1.3 billion Chinese are a slightly different setup, and, you know, Confucian traditions in Singapore didn't exist to the same extent they did in Confucian
Will,
China.
Sorry to interrupt you. You had 5 minutes, 5 minutes ago. So now you've got 3
okay.
minutes, but
I've
you,
got, I've
we
got
need to wrap
Chinese
it up.
Chinese bonds, is that a weapon? It certainly is, and I think it's one of the reasons why I think what David said was very telling. It's there's a system of mutual dependence there, but I think it's an unstable system of mutual dependence. That's to say, I think there comes a moment when the flow of money into American bonds has to slow down. Indeed, I think is slowing down. And then there was a last point which I can't read my own writing. Maybe I should just because we're so overrunning. What was that? There was a piece about China. It was the last question. Who was that? Oh, Gordon Brown. I mean, China has a... You're right. I mean, China's lowered world price levels. China is the reason why we can have a... I mean, it caused the oil price to rise, but it's actually the reason why there isn't an inflationary effect. China's been driven 40% of world increase in demand for the last 5 years. China's the reason why interest rates can remain at their current level. There's lots of... I mean, the China effect has been, has been very beneficial on Western economies. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I argue, and perhaps I wasn't time, you know, it underlies my point about, you know, staying open. I think we should, you know, China, we benefit from China. We benefit from trade with China. It is a source of benefit to us. But we need to be aware that, you know, that it's not, and we can be confident about trading with it because it isn't an all-conquering Goliath. That's my big point. And I think it has these fundamental issues. And David, I've got, I think that your point was well made about financial not financially liberalizing and the infant, whilst actually and keeping control of its financial system. Fundamental point, even while it stays open. You know, the infant industry argument would work better if there are any infant industries that you could identify that have grown. I mean, the average Chinese firm is 70 strong, run by, you know, you must have seen them in the street, a man in a black Mercedes paying his workers with a out of a black cash box. I mean, that is actually the typical Guanxi Chinese enterprise. You know, frankly, the best thing to do was to open it up in the way that they've done. And actually, the big debate in China is why is not more made in China by Chinese rather than becoming a kind of workshop of the world owned by foreigners. And, but, you know, 20 million out of poverty, the world's fourth biggest economy from nothing 25 years ago, you've got to acknowledge this is an achievement.
I think that a remarkable lecture, tour de force, Will. Thank you so much. It was one of the best lectures I've heard in a very, very long time.
You're